Welcome to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Media. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Florida continues emerging from our stay-at-home and business shutdown or slowdown orders that were issued to slow the spread of COVID-19. Now, the two most populous counties will join the rest of the state next week in reopening parts of their economies. Miami-Dade and Broward counties are home to about half of all coronavirus infections here in Florida.
Yeah, where I am here today, Melissa, in Miami, we're just beginning to restart. Where you are in Jacksonville, well, pushing ahead to expand the reopening. The Jacksonville mayor wants to allow restaurants to welcome in more customers, for instance. Many beaches are open across the state, but not all of them. Restaurant dining rooms are back open. Some stores, shopping malls are opening their doors as well. Now, Governor Ron DeSantis is scheduled to hold a news conference in Jacksonville as we begin our live program on this Friday at noon.
That's right, Tom. We'll monitor what the governor has to say. And as you've pointed out, different parts of the state are handling this differently. Later on here on the show, we'll talk about the health data the governor used to make these reopening decisions and what the state needs to be doing to make sure a second wave of the virus doesn't hit. We'll also look into the problems thousands of you around the state are still having as you try to file for unemployment.
Yeah, you can get those phone calls in early, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or send us a tweet, at Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. First, a tour around the state. Folks haven't been doing a whole lot of traveling, so we're going to belt you in and take you across the peninsula here at Florida in the Sunshine State and hear how the reopening is going in various locations, courtesy of public radio reporters across the state. Let's begin down at the southernmost point. Nan Klingener covers the Florida Keys in Monroe County for WLRN. Nan, what's open right now in the Keys?
Well, Monroe County was the only South Florida county that went into phase one on May 4th with the rest of the state outside of mainland South Florida. So we have retail open at 50% occupancy. Restaurants are at 25% occupancy inside, and outside the tables have to be 6 feet apart. Salons are open at 25% occupancy, and the county is telling people to wear masks in public settings.
Requiring folks to wear those masks?
I think when they're inside in a congregated place, yes.
Yeah.
Not outside.
The checkpoints on two roads that lead from the mainland into the Keys remain in place. It's a community unto itself, the Florida Keys, in so many ways. But the ban on non-essential visitors remains. How complicated is that, given the fact that it's reopening, whereas its neighbors to the north, Miami-Dade and Broward, have yet to?
Yeah, it's really complicated. And in fact, just last night, there was a lawsuit filed in Monroe Circuit Court about that. And I'm thinking we may hear from the county very soon about when they plan to lift that checkpoint outside of a court order, of course, if that comes out of this lawsuit. But yeah, it's very complicated, and they're turning a lot of people away at that checkpoint.
Now, the Keys relies heavily on tourism, just about more than any other part of the state. And there was a small group of folks that were out on Tuesday protesting that checkpoint. Let's listen.
It's time. It's time. Our people need to work. They need the money for their families.
We just want to fish. We want them to open the hotels so people can come in, fly in. They don't have to open the border, but let them fly in so we can all get a little bit of work, maybe not a lot right away, but we would need to get started because we have no income.
That was Bonnie Bowick with Hooked Up Charters, a fishing charter, and Ed Swift, who runs the Historic Tours of America in Key West. So with its neighbors expected to begin phase one reopening on Monday of next week, how will that affect Monroe County, Nan?
I'm not really sure, but they might have to, you know, turn away even more people at the checkpoint. We saw increases in boat traffic off the Upper Keys on recent weekends as the marinas reopened in Miami. We'll see. The county has said until now that they have no plans to reopen to visitors through the end of this month, and that includes the Memorial Day weekend, which is traditionally packed down here.
Yeah, less than 2 weeks away right now. Nan Klingener, the southernmost reporter for WLRN, with us here on the Florida Roundup from Key West.
Let's head up the peninsula now to the Tampa-St. Pete area. Stephanie Colombini is a reporter with WUSF there. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
Good to have you. So what's open in the Tampa, St. Pete, Sarasota areas?
Real similar to what Nan was saying with restaurants, beaches, nail salons, all that limited capacity. We do have some beaches here that are still closed. Lido Beach in Sarasota, that's still a point of controversy where some people are, you know, really pushing for it to be open, but the government is not choosing to reopen that beach. There's still a lot of restaurants because of the capacity requirements that have chosen to remain takeout only because, you know, unless you have a lot of outdoor seating or a really large space, 25% capacity, it's not necessarily economically viable. So there are, you know, not all restaurants have taken that step. So some are still closed altogether for safety concerns. So we're definitely seeing more reopen, but not everybody. It wasn't a giant wave of, you know, everything's back to normal.
So it sounds like kind of a mixed bag then in your neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm. I think you can, most restaurants at this point, now that we're about to, are choosing to reopen. People are expecting the governor to up that capacity requirement to 50% as soon as noon to make that announcement. We're seeing with Miami-Dade getting to reopen next week that their plan to have 50% capacity was approved. So it is expected the state will go the same route, and then I think we could expect a lot more restaurants in this area to reopen.
All right. And back in April, a local pastor in your area got arrested for holding an in-person service after Hillsborough County issued a stay-at-home order. What's the situation right now with faith groups as this next phase of reopening gets ready to get underway?
Yeah, it's been really slow. You know, religious gatherings have been allowed, but we aren't seeing too many churches or synagogues jump on that just yet. This week, Catholic churches returned to daily Mass, meaning just Monday through Saturday services because they draw less crowds typically. So Sunday services are still not in person. They're virtual only. And we're aware that a lot of religious groups are having those conversations about how you do social distancing mm-hmm. inside of a church or a synagogue, and you know, do you skip the offering basket that everybody passes around? How do you do communion? It's a really complicated subject, and not many groups have decided how they're going to return to in-person yet.
And quickly, if you could, can you tell us about your experience getting a coronavirus test?
Yeah. Just a couple weeks ago, Hillsborough County opened up testing to everybody, including people who don't have symptoms. So myself and my boyfriend don't have symptoms, but we mm-hmm. both work. You know, I have to go into work about once a week. My boyfriend works at a grocery store right now, so figured we could be exposed. We went to the county drive-thru site at Raymond James Stadium, and it was a pretty smooth process. Honestly, the biggest headache was getting on the phone and scheduling the appointment. That took a long time, but mm-hmm. the actual test itself was quite simple. The real frustration for us, even though we were happy to both be negative, was that it took about 5 days for us to get our results. And so you're always kind of wondering, well, what happened in between those five
sure.
days? And then really hoping to get more rapid results on tests in the future.
And glad to hear you're negative. Stephanie Colombini with us from yeah. WUSF in Tampa. Thanks, Stephanie.
Just south is the Naples-Fort Myers area. Carrie Barber covers that area for our public radio sister station, WGCU in Fort Myers. Carrie, welcome to the program. Naples had to close its beach after reopening it. It was closed for just a short time, but what happened there?
That's right. It was they reopened the beaches, and it became so crowded immediately on that first day that they shut it down, and then there was a very long, tortured meeting about what to do next. And what they decided to do is to reopen the Naples. This is the Naples City beaches mm-hmm. with limited hours, sunrise to sunset on weekends, which will include Memorial Day weekend. Sunrise to sunset on weekdays. On weekends, it's going to have this bifurcated schedule, 7 to 11 a.m. and 5 to sunset. So you can't bring a cooler. You can bring a chair to look at the sunset. You have to have a beach sticker. So they're doing all they can to kind of limit the number of people that are going to be on the beach.
You have to have a beach sticker. Does that mean residents only can get on the sand?
To park, that is. I'm
gotcha.
Sorry.
It's, okay.
It's limiting the parking, yeah.
So not a way to close the beach to visitors, but certainly to discourage visitors that don't have that beach parking for Naples to go visit the sand. How would you How would you describe the use of masks, facial covering, social distancing there along the Naples area in Fort Myers?
I think people have been pretty compliant with the masks and the social distancing. I think like elsewhere in the state, people are getting a little bit antsy and a little bit tired of the social distancing, et cetera. And they wonder, I feel like they're getting the signal from the governor that it's time to stop all this craziness. But I do see a lot of good compliance around here. Yeah.
You mentioned the governor there. The governor talking now as we're live on this Friday. And one of the things he's talking about, of course, is continued testing. What is the state of testing facilities there in Southwest Florida?
They just opened two more testing sites in Fort Myers that are open only three mornings a week, and they're only open to those same old protocol of people with symptoms or first responders, or it's open only to a very limited group of people. So I would not call it widespread testing is available here, but I'd say limited testing. And they just brought some testing in for the Immokalee. A lot of the agriculture workers were able to get tested, but I wouldn't call it widespread.
Carrie Barber, reporter for WGCU based in Fort Myers. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now we're going to head up to Northeast Florida. Sitting in studio with me, WJCT's own Sky LeBron. Hi, Sky.
Hey, Melissa.
All right. So Governor DeSantis is giving a news conference right here in Jacksonville as we speak. Mayor Lenny Curry, meanwhile, said this week that he thinks Jacksonville is ready to move into the next phase of reopening. So farther ahead, farther down the road than the South Florida counties, what do we know about what's going to happen in Jacksonville next week?
Well, something that Mayor Curry brought up yesterday was that it might not be necessarily phase two just yet, but it could be an extension of phase one. So I think we're going to get some more information on that today, on what that could be. That could include the reopening of gyms in a limited capacity, increased capacity at restaurants. And we've already seen the city council here in Jacksonville kind of ease pressure on businesses. Zoning regulations have been relaxed so they can sell and seat more outside with some limitations, like you can't block sidewalks and things like that. But overall, we've heard from people a lot of concerns, rightfully so, for vulnerable populations. But there's also a lot of people who want to get back to work and reopen their businesses.
That's right. Now, the governor has frequently cited Jacksonville's success in keeping the curve flat of virus transmissions. He's praised the social distancing, the stay-at-home practices, the mask wearing throughout this region, giving that all credit. The mayor did have a mask on at the press conference we're hearing that's going on now with Governor DeSantis. The governor does not have on a mask, apparently, right now. But data shows that people adopting these practices voluntarily has helped flatten the curve, right?
Yeah, and here in Northeast Florida, I've definitely seen the social distancing. We've seen it a lot in all businesses that you go to. That seems like something that's been widely practiced. Masks have been a little bit scarce, I would say, when in terms of people actually wearing them. When I've been to stores and a couple times I've gone out to do some stories, I've been in the minority of people wearing a mask. But that this isn't because the mayor, Mayor Curry, he is still suggesting it on every single press conference
And he has warned it at times. Quickly, the state of testing in Jacksonville, including the new antibody testing at the state testing site at the NFL stadium, TIAA Bank Field.
Yeah, that is still only available to first responders and healthcare workers. So the way that people can get that antibody testing is through their private health
private
provider.
Insurer.
Yeah.
Right. He's WJCT's Sky LeBron in Jacksonville with me. Thank you, Sky.
Thank you.
Let's go to the middle of the state and catch up with Joe Burns that covers the Villages for WMFE, our sister station based in Orlando. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Hi.
A lot of folks have been calling this the new normal, the beginning of the new normal. So what does that look like in a community like the Villages?
Well, right now, I'm at Lake Sumter Landing in the Villages. So I'm sitting looking at what people are doing, right? The restaurants are sparsely attended, but almost no one is wearing a mask, except for the employees at the restaurant. I think I've seen three of the senior citizens who are actually wearing masks. Driving by the golf courses coming here, I saw people out playing in groups. No apparent social distancing going on in those groups. Now, maybe they live in the same house, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's doubtful. So I think, you know, their numbers are not looking too bad.
In terms of the infection numbers there in Sumter County and in that area, regarding the masks, the facial coverings, the social distancing, we've seen a number of establishments, restaurants and retail stores that are beginning to reopen will post signs telling folks that, you know, you're not going to be allowed in unless you have the appropriate facial covering. And there'll be even X's on the floor marking out 6 feet away from your fellow consumer, customer, shopper. Are those kind of practices in place in some of these establishments in the Villages?
Well, there are restrictions that you can see signs on the doors about the restrictions that they have there. I'm not seeing any restrictions indicating the masks are required, but they are applying some of those social distancing practices in the stores, yes.
As you've been reporting on this over the last many weeks at the Villages, is there a sense of a new normal as the governor and Florida begin to reemerge from the stay-at-home orders, or is it back to the old normal in the Villages?
Well, if you believe that people are following the rules, it is a new normal. Yesterday, the Villages announced that it will be opening the pickleball courts, the tennis courts, the ping pong courts, which is great. You know, people, this is what people want in their life here. They want to be able to enjoy these recreational activities, but they added a lot of restrictions, you know, spacing, different rules about bringing your own equipment, bringing your own water, bringing your own chair rather than sitting on a bench, sanitizing the balls and things like that. So, there are new rules, but a lot of the old activities are beginning to open up. And that starts on Monday.
Talk to us about kind of the importance of those kinds of activities in a community like the Villages, which has a reputation of being an extremely social community.
Yes, yes, indeed. That's it. In talking with one of the local supervisors here early on in this pandemic, that's what he said. He said, that's why people are here. They enjoy that. You know, they're retired. They have a lot of time on their hands, and this is how they want to spend that time, with these recreational activities and with clubs and things like that. Now, some of the meetings of clubs at the recreation centers, some of the lifestyle activities haven't been opened up yet. But a lot of those other things, that's what they want, right? They want to be able to enjoy their retirement, doing these types of activities, and that was largely shut down for a while, with the exception of golf. They began to open up a little earlier this month, and on Monday, the pickleball courts and things like that will be a big improvement.
A big change, right? And watching what that new normal may look like on the pickleball courts in the Villages could give us a little bit of insight into the future of what that community is dealing with and going to deal with here. Joe Burns covers the Villages in that area. Joe, we got to go, but I do appreciate your time today. Joe's a reporter with our sister station based in Orlando, WMFE. We're going to talk about the what's needed to prevent any second wave in Florida. That's next when the Florida Roundup continues.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. When Governor Ron DeSantis began talking about lifting restrictions put in place to slow the spread of COVID-19, he spent a lot of time criticizing early predictions of how bad the virus could hurt Florida. Remember those early predictions? Some early models projected overwhelmed hospitals across the state, an enormous surge of cases, and a big jump in deaths.
That's right, Tom. Now, the images that were shared around the world of spring break parties and crowded Florida beaches in March did help reinforce fears of the possibility of a widespread outbreak. Some local officials closed beaches and businesses before the governor issued that statewide stay-at-home order. And while almost 2,000 people in Florida have died from the virus, what we've mostly seen around the state falls far short of the most dire predictions. So, how did Florida escape the worst of the COVID crisis? New this week, an analysis of cell phone tracking data by the Tampa Bay Times found a lot of you out there just slowed down and stayed home of your own free will before you were ordered to do so. That may have made the difference. Many people around the state reduced their movements, in particular after local school districts announced their closings. And those came days or even weeks before the local and the state orders to stay at home.
So as Florida begins this phased reopening, continues the phased reopening across much of the state, what is necessary to prevent a second wave of COVID-19? Dr. Tom Latish is with us, a University of Florida research scientist who specializes in disease modeling, and he's been a consultant to the state health department. Dr. Latish, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Is it appropriate for Florida to reopen in the way that it is, in your estimation?
That's a tricky question. It's a little, asking an epidemiologist that is a little bit like asking a doctor what's the right number of cigarettes to smoke. But
I asked the question not to be tricky, doctor, to be fair, just curious as to your opinion, because you have this knowledge that a lot of us don't.
Sure. So as a human, I recognize that, you know, keeping the population locked down is not something we can just do indefinitely. It has great economic and psychological costs. And so I think that what we're doing right now is reasonable in terms of having a gradual and phased reopening. My biggest concern is that we need to have adequate infrastructure in place to evaluate whether these changes are having an unacceptable impact, and to know that quickly, because one of the big challenges with COVID is that it takes quite a while for us to be able to detect transmission. When someone gets infected, it takes about 5 days for them to develop symptoms, another couple of days for them to get sick enough to get tested. And then in some cases, it can take up to a week to get test results back. So that means that when you change policy, you don't necessarily know the impact of that policy for another 2 weeks after that.
So let's focus on that infrastructure. The University of Florida's Emerging Pathogens Institute model that you've been part of has said, quote, robust testing, contact tracing, and household quarantining could offset a second pandemic, end quote. So let's tackle that piece by piece here, Dr. Latish. Robust testing. Is Florida robustly testing for COVID-19 right now?
I think this is an open question about what the right number of tests is. I personally think that the amount of testing that we're doing right now may be sufficient. We need to be smart about how we're testing. We need to make sure that we're detecting transmission in populations that may not normally be very quick to seek healthcare. And we also need to be aggressive about tracing detection and keeping good data, tracing transmission and keeping good data on the setting where that took place. So for example, if you're reopening restaurants, there are some places outside of Florida where restaurants are required to keep a log of customers. And so that makes it possible to actually go back and say, okay, we know that someone who was at this restaurant became infected. We need to go and test the other people who were at the restaurant at the same time.
Is that good practice? Is that something that ought to be emulated here in Florida as we're seeing?
Absolutely. I think that approaches like that would be extremely valuable. You know, it's
would
not
that be expanded to even shopping malls and retail stores?
So, you know, it's certainly possible to do things like that. Cell phone companies, for most of us, they know where we are all the time.
Yeah.
It does get into privacy concerns, mm-hmm. and you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really speak to those issues. I think one of the big challenges that we as Americans may be faced with is to what extent are we willing to give up some of that privacy in exchange for freedom of movement. And you know, that's a really That's a really difficult question. I don't know the answer to that one.
It's a thought experiment that's playing out in real time with real life consequences right now in Florida, but across the country and, of course, across the world. Dr. Tom Ladish is with us, University of Florida research scientist specializing in disease modeling here on the Florida Roundup. Let me focus in here on testing a little bit more, Dr. Ladish. As you mentioned, you seem to think that Florida may be doing enough testing. We're doing about 17,000 tests, as reported by the State Department of Health, each and every day. The modeling that the UF and others have done regarding preventing a second wave assume finding half of the people who are infected and are exhibiting active symptoms. So is that 17,000? Is that enough? As you work through the health statistics, does that work out to be a kind of an accurate goal each and every day for Florida to test in order to find the virus fast enough to prevent a second wave?
The amount of testing you need to do scales with the number of people who are infected. And so that's part of the reason it's a bit of a tricky question, because if this blows up and we get a large second wave, then it's going to rapidly become inadequate, that amount of testing. So, you know, one of the reasons I say that it seems to be enough right now is based on the fraction of test results that are coming back positive. The guidelines, typically, I think this is from the CDC, are that we want to see a positive test fraction under 10%. And I saw an estimate yesterday that we were at about 3.3%. So that suggests that you know, at least according to that criterion, we are testing enough. But like I said, you know, when you have something that can grow exponentially, that can very rapidly become insufficient. So
What kind of testing are we talking about here, doctor? The is it the antibody test or the nasal swab test?
So I would characterize them. I would put them in slightly different categories. You're either testing for the presence of the virus or you're testing for an acquired immune response due to a past infection. So the nasal swab test is generally you'd be doing a PCR test and you'd be checking to see if someone is shedding the virus.
And when we're talking about the testing to try to get to prevent a second wave, is the focus on that nasal swab test?
Yeah, and the nasal swab thing I wouldn't characterize it that way, because we're also talking about oral swabs. You can do blood samples. The point is you're testing for the presence of the virus.
Gotcha. Not necessarily just a nasal swab test then.
It can come from urine, feces, blood. You can apply that kind of testing to different bodily fluids.
Dr. Lettuce, let me focus on the contact tracing now, because that's another piece that you obviously referred to in your research. Colleagues at the Emerging Pathogens Institute have also focused on to do contact tracing with, they've estimated in their modeling, 40% of the people who are found to be actively infected with symptoms. Is Florida putting in place infrastructure to accomplish that?
That's a good question. I don't know as well as I would like. I don't find the process to be completely transparent. I have asked about this, and
the Department of Health?
Yeah, it's not clear to me exactly how contact tracing is being executed right now.
So the Department of Health, in its latest public statements, says that it has more than 1,000 contact tracers in the state. The National Association of County and City Health Officials suggests the number of people involved in contact tracing should be about 30 per 100,000. The math on that would then lead us to about 6,000 people doing contact tracing in Florida. But you're unaware, in the position you're in, even as an advisor to the DOH, about its process around contact tracing. Is that correct?
I believe it is changing. And yes, unfortunately, it is not particularly transparent.
And do you have any reason to help explain the opacity that's involved there?
Honestly, no. my stance as a scientist is that there should be maximum transparency about process. For that reason, when I publish models, the code goes on the internet and anyone in the world can look at it. That's not necessarily the same policy that that governments follow. It's kind of a standard that's established in academia. And so I think that there are some cultural differences.
That leads me to this question, Dr. Ladish, and in the level of your confidence in all the data that the state is publicly releasing, how would you describe that level of confidence you have?
I think that the challenge is that a lot of people have had to switch tasks and be mobilized in order to address the response here. And so in some cases, people who were not normally doing work like this are now responsible for collecting and making available the state data. And the fact that those processes have changed over time during the response means that numbers sometimes have gotten updated in ways that are confusing. I don't think that there's any intent to deceive people by doing this. I think it's just a complicated job to manage the amount of data and the changing situation.
Dr. Ladish, we have just less than a minute left, which is not enough time to fully explore this next question, but I just want to get your quick idea here. What do we know about immunity for those who have tested positive for the antibodies?
I think that there's certainly more that we need to know. I think that the best guess right now is that people do retain durable immunity. It may only last a couple of years. So it may be possible to get reinfected in the future, and that's something that only time will tell. But I don't think we're dealing with a situation where someone could get reinfected after weeks, for example.
Dr. Tom Ladish is a University of Florida research scientist specializing in disease modeling, and he has been a consultant to the State Department of Health. Dr. Ladish, thank you so much for your time today and your expertise.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Let's shift gears now, because people out of work throughout Florida are so frustrated by the ongoing problems with the state system. As they try to file for unemployment, often they can't get online and they can't get anyone on the phone. Turns out the call takers fielding all those calls are frustrated, too. This week, we learned more about what the people taking your call to process unemployment claims are actually being told to say. Jamie Girola is a reporter with NBC 6 Miami and joins us now. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon. How are you?
Great to have you. Now, you obtained what these call takers call pre-shift notes. It gives them instructions on how to handle claimants who finally get through on the phone to them. What are they being told to say?
Well, you know, first of all, to hundreds of thousands of people who've been waiting for unemployment checks, they say the Department of Economic Opportunity has been a nightmare. And since this all started, NBC6 Response has fielded hundreds of emails and phone calls from people frustrated with the system, either not being able to get in and get on with a rep or not even getting payments. So, like you said, earlier this week, we spoke with DEO workers. I spoke with two myself, and one is particularly vocal about the challenges that she faces when trying to help these frustrated claimants. She says all she wants to do is be able to help them get their money, get them on their way, and move on to the next person. But she says doing that really isn't so easy, and that the DEO isn't providing them resources to get the job done. Now, you mentioned those pre-shift notes, and basically what they're saying is that what we all know to be glitches within the system, that they're not actually allowed to call those glitches. They have to refer to them and say the system is processing payments and is unavailable, or improvements are being made to the system at the time. So that's just one example. Another thing that this woman told me, who most of these call workers now, they're contracted, so they're spread out throughout the country. They may not even be in Florida. And they're taking in sensitive information, which scares some of these potential claimants. And this call taker told me that some of the tasks that people need to get done are so simple that it would take 5 minutes for her to do. But instead, She has them on hold for 3 hours just to try to get a page to load. And she actually wonders how many other people could she have actually been helping if the system was actually working.
Okay, you've relayed the results of your investigation to state lawmakers. What are they telling you?
Well, I did speak with Senator Jason Pizzo about this story. He's also hearing from workers, and he said that what we found really helped make the governor's office aware that the call center workers are not delivering the service that the public was told they'd receive, because the state of Florida has spent over $100 million on temp workers to, what he says, stall and deflect from providing actual service. And you can just go online on Facebook and all of these unemployment groups, and that's basically what people are getting, is being told that they have to try another number and another number and another number. But Senator Pizzo did say that it reinforces their earlier call from legislators to participate. They want to participate directly and unveil the clandestine inactivity within the DEO. And they said that if they can't process these claimants efficiently, that lawmakers need to have access.
It is amazing to contemplate that the state of Florida has spent $100 million for all of these call takers who cannot execute these calls. Jamie, great reporting from you. Thank you for joining us. Jamie Garola with NBC 6 Miami. Appreciate that. And we want you to call us wherever you are in Florida at 305-995-1800 if you've had trouble filing for unemployment. We're getting your tweets and emails, too. We're going to take a quick break and then share some of your stories and find out what's being done to get you some relief as we speak with State Representative Anna Escamani of Orlando about this ongoing crisis. There are also calls for a federal investigation into this, too. So how about it, Florida? Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup. Let us know how you're doing as we look at the state's unemployment mess. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Media. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Give us a call here on the Florida Roundup if you've had trouble getting unemployment in the state. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. We're getting lots of tweets. Here's one from Betsy. She says, the governor continues to ignore the thousands of us whose lives have been destroyed because of his inefficiency, she says. Even Disney workers haven't been paid. I've been trying for 2 months to get my account unlocked and haven't seen one payment, she says. All right, let's welcome right now State Representative Anna Escamani, Democrat of Orlando. She's been working for weeks now to get answers from the state and get her constituents unemployment relief. Representative Escamani, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa, and for covering this really important topic.
It really is. Now, what's the latest information you're getting from the DEO? That's the Department of Economic Opportunity. They're managing this whole situation, or trying to.
It's been a mess from day one. I mean, even as a state lawmaker, we struggle to get the most accurate, up-to-date information from DEO and DMS. And in fact, you know, one of the latest questions that I've had for these agencies are, do folks who qualify for PUA, do they have to also modify their claim for back pay? Much like members of our community who have qualified for state unemployment, and even for a question as straightforward and simple as that, I can't get an answer. So we're constantly, you know, identifying trends from those who contact us, trying to get some clarity from DO, and then, you know, being that facilitator of accurate information and actions to take, because the administration and these executive agencies just aren't getting it done.
And PUA is Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. That's just the acronym there. Now, a group of members of Congress from Florida, they're calling for an independent federal investigation into this. They want the GAO, the Government Accountability Office in Washington, to look into this. What's your take on that?
I fully support that effort. You know, we have been asking for an investigation for weeks now. And finally, the governor said, you know, he's open to a state investigation, but I don't think that's good enough. Unfortunately, the state had already reported mistakes with the website and areas of improvement with the website. And the governor said he never got that report. And we just found out today that it actually was emailed to him in March 2019. And so at this point, I think it's pretty clear that our state executive branch cannot be trusted to oversight this program and to investigate themselves. So we really do need an outside investigation.
Lots of calls coming into the Florida Roundup. Let's go to Tim in Sarasota. Hi, Tim. What's your situation?
Well, I fit in a unique category. I moved to Florida 2 years ago, spent a year getting settled in. I'm 58 years old. I finally had a job accepted offer teaching at Manatee County Schools, and my start date was after spring break. Well, as you know, the schools closed down for spring break, so my date never really starts, so I really never had any gainful employment in Florida. So when I had to file, I first filed and couldn't get on. I mean, it took me a month and a half almost to get on. No phone calls. I spent probably 500 phone calls.
Yeah.
But now if I try and file, and I finally filed and I was declared ineligible because I have no employment in Florida, but you had to file for the unemployment first, and then you had to file for the PUA. And now that I filed for the PUA, it says I'm ineligible because I have no state income in the state of Florida. Well, the PUA is supposed to be paying me for compensating me from the federal program, not the state, the federal program.
Yeah.
Supposed to be compensating me for my time.
So you're wondering, I guess, what to do, right? I mean, yeah, Anna Escamani, what should someone like Tim, what options does he have?
It's a great question. And so my first reaction, and again, I don't know Tim's exact steps that he's taken claim-wise, and I'm happy to learn more about it, but my first piece of advice for everyone in that situation is definitely make sure you actually apply for PUA. I only say that because we've had, at this point, two constituents we've worked with who thought they applied for PUA and were deemed ineligible, but in fact, they actually never started the PUA link because it's very confusing. You have to be, you have to have reapplied for traditional reemployment assistance after April 5th, then be deemed ineligible again, and then 72 hours or so after that second ineligibility is when the PUA link popped up on people's Connect accounts, and then they apply for PUA, and then they wait again. So I just want to make sure that for folks like Tim, you know, just to double check that you actually did apply for PUA, because he's right about the base period. The PUA base period should not be as long. It's much, much shorter. And if he's had some sort of self-employment that he can demonstrate wages were lost in the last 30 days,
yeah,
he should be able to apply for PUA.
Tim, I hope that is at least somewhat helpful to you. And I wish you luck. And I'm sorry you're going through this, Tim. Thanks for the call. Okay, let's go to Rob in Apopka. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. How are you?
Okay, what's your situation? Hey, Rob, we're having trouble hearing you. You know what? Let's try another call. Rob, are you still there?
I am.
Go ahead, quickly.
Just the back pay. March 17th was my last day of work, and I just got my first PUA payment about a week ago, but what to do about back payment?
Okay, so he got some money, Representative Escamani, but he wants back payment.
Right.
How about that?
Right. So excellent question. So for PUA back payment, we're trying to confirm with DO what, if anything, folks need to do. You know, PUA has been crafted by Congress to be retroactive, but unfortunately, there is confusion in Connect because at this point, the start date is not reflective when folks actually became unemployed. It's reflective when they had to reapply. So we're actively asking DO for more details on what folks in your situation should do. I'll add that if you are receiving state benefits and are seeking to modify your start date, there is a form on floridajobs.org where you can request to modify your claim if you're receiving traditional reemployment assistance or RA.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. As we talk with State Representative Anna Escamani of Orlando, she's been working for weeks now to try to help constituents across the state having trouble accessing unemployment benefits, or PUA, as the abbreviation goes. What's the most common complaint you're trying to resolve right now for folks out there?
That's a great question, Melissa. It's pending. It's people who are in this pending purgatory. And whether they have been waiting since March or now April, it's folks that just have no direction on why their case is pending, and they're willing to take whatever action necessary to move it, but there's no communication. And that brings me to the second most common complaint, which is the call center for DO, as was already mentioned on the show, people just can't get through to anyone who can actually help them with their claim.
Now, we are seeing these calls from Florida members of Congress, all Democrats, we need to point out, calling for a federal investigation into Florida's unemployment mess and also recommending reforms. What would be the most valuable reform to this system, in your view?
Well, one is to make just the application process more attainable. You know, Florida is very unique in that the only way to apply is online. I mean, they added the paper form late, you know, just because of COVID-19, but in every average day, you can only apply through this Connect website, which is already a website that can't handle the capacity. But if you're technologically not savvy or don't have a computer, then you're already limited. We have folks who have disabilities and they can't use a computer. So I think the first thing is just that access point. There needs to be the ability to apply over the phone. There needs to be an ability to track all payments, including federal payments. So there needs just to be a complete revamp of this website, a new website completely. That would be one of the most transformational changes. And then second to that is the eligibility policy attached to the Connect system, because as Tim, our first caller, mentioned, you know, Florida has very strict eligibility requirements, and a large number of people are not eligible because of how strict Florida is in determining whether you qualify or not.
Representative Escamani, it's Tom Hudson. What's the oversight role for the state legislature in this?
It's a great question, Tom. And I wish I could do even more of that oversight, because as most listeners already know, you know, we're a separate branch of government, right? So I'm in the legislature. DO is under the executive branch, under the oversight of the governor of Florida. We have requested a special session, myself and Democratic colleagues. We sent letters to the Secretary of State. We got enough support to pull the idea of a special session to make it happen. And unfortunately, it failed along party line votes. I am not in Tallahassee right now for session. I can't even file a bill if I wanted to, because we're not in legislative session. So we need to go back to Tallahassee with session so we can actually, you know, change the policy approach, try to make this program easier to access. And unfortunately, right now, the only person with the oversight is the governor, and he's the only one who could even do executive orders to try to change, you know, parts of the process, which I will flag has also been frustrating, because many of his executive orders were not operationalized in Connect, creating a lot of problems.
Have you given consideration going to the judicial branch?
Absolutely. Well, as folks know, a lawsuit was filed, and so there was a class action lawsuit that's in process. Unfortunately, during its first hearing, it was dismissed by the judge, because Florida law does not actually define prompt when it comes to Chapter 443, which is the chapter that reviews all of the unemployment program. Prompt is never defined, so it was difficult to, you know, seek a lawsuit when you can't actually demonstrate where they broke the law, because prompt is not defined in Florida law.
Here's one more tweet from Arielle. She says, my father can't get through to get an answer. His company let 150 employees go in one day with no warning. So the pain is real. I want to thank you, State Representative Anna Escamani, for joining us. She is a Democrat of Orlando. We appreciate you sharing this with our listeners around the state. Thanks so much.
Proud to do it. Thank you, Melissa.
Governor Ron DeSantis now saying that on Monday we will see the first full day of full phase one reopening of Florida, Tom, and everything that goes along with that. So we'll continue following the changes around Florida.
We're going to be joining you from South Florida in that reopening phase as we see restaurants welcome back in dining experience, some retail stores, shopping malls reopening as South Florida joins the rest of Florida in this reopening phase after these stay-at-home orders were put in place more than a month ago.
And that is our show for today. The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. The Director of Radio Operations is Peter Maritz. He's also our Technical Director. We get engineering help each week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday at noon.